Good afternoon, and welcome to Animal Voices on CFRO 102.7 on your FM dial. This show is presented through the cooperation of three local groups, Earth Save Canada, Animal Defense and Anti-Vivisection, and the Vancouver Humane Society. Voices or views expressed on the show are not necessarily those of these organizations. My name is Marge Adams. In the studio with me are Alan Jensen, our announcer and technician, and co-hosts Carl Loskin, John Pranger, and All Art. At the top of today's show, we'll be speaking with Rob Bennett. Rob is an entomologist who is employed by the BC Ministry of Forest and Range. He'll be talking to us about spiders. And later we'll be hearing from Mona Benj. Carl will be interviewing her about the proposed amendments to the BC Wildlife Act. The government wants to increase the number of hunters by 20,000 new hunters by the year 2014. So that certainly is something that needs to be thought about. All Art will be completing her presentation from last week on chimeras. I got that wrong. I had it all right a few minutes ago. John Pranger will be talking about millions of missing birds. So we have a full show ahead, and just before we get going, we are going to ask John for an announcement.
Yeah, just to let you know that we've got a couple of tickets to the Vancouver Folk Festival to give away. That's a $70 dollar prize times two is $140, and all we ask is for you to become a new member or renew your membership if you are a member and need to renew it. So for $50, you get a $140 prize. That's two tickets to the Vancouver Folk Festival, which is, what's the date on that?
It's next Saturday.
Next Saturday, from July 13th to 15th.
So
this
the
is a general admission for all 3 days. Is that
no,
right?
No, it's just for one day. For Saturday, which is a very good deal. I mean, you get the whole, it's 12 hours of music, so it's a good deal.
All right, so July 1st, so the Saturday is what this
14th,
ticket is for.
14th. July.
Okay, so that's
so
a great prize.
So people should call after the show, right?
Because right,
we're
right
all
after
here
the
in
show.
The control room now, so we cannot answer the phone. So we will remind you again of the phone number and of the tickets at the end of today's show, and then you can call us at 12 o'clock.
Yeah, thanks for that, John. Now, we do have a couple of minutes, I think, before Rob will be calling in. I have a little joke I'll tell you. And this is about a burglar. And the burglar was walking down the street with his empty duffel bag. He looked up, saw what appeared to be a house without people in it. So he broke in and started to fill his duffel bag with whatever was valuable around. As he was doing this, he stopped and heard a voice. It said, "Jesus is watching." So he stopped filling his bag, listened, and nothing else was heard. He decided, "Oh, I've been working too hard. I'm going to have to cool off. I must be hearing things." And then he went on filling his bag once again. And then he heard, "Jesus is watching." He takes out his flashlight and beams it around the room. And there it is, a parrot in a cage. So he walked towards the parrot, a very, very beautiful bird, and he said, "What's your name?" The parrot answered, "Moses." "What kind of name is Moses for a parrot? Who would ever name a parrot Moses?" And the parrot responded, "The same guy who named his 150-pound Pitbull Jesus." Anyway, that's my joke of the day. We probably have a few tips. I was reading about wild salmon. Now, this was something that has been concerning us for a long time because of the terrible situation they are suffering as a result of escapees and lice from the salmon farms right on the coast. And this is what it said. Wild salmon has as much as three times the amount of beneficial omega-3 oils as farmed varieties. Higher levels of the antioxidant which is a word I can't pronounce here, and less fat, making it one of the best choices for healthy eating. So if you are a fish eater, steer clear of the farmed fish. They're so bad for the wild salmon.
Steer clear of all fish would save you mercury accumulation in your body.
I was just
and they're very good sources of omega-3s in nature, walnuts, and of course flax seeds are a very good source of omega-3s.
Oh, I just wanted to add to what you were saying about wild salmon. I don't know if you've read about what the U.S. government is planning to do to create fish farms off Alaska. The Alaskan government won't allow fish farms, very smartly for them, because they realize that the disaster of fish farms. So the U.S. government is talking about licensing fish farms that could be in international waters off Alaska, more than 3 miles offshore.
And up to 200 miles.
Right. As long as it's more than 3 miles and up to 200 miles, it's waters controlled by the federal government in the U.S. And apparently it's feasible to have a fish farm out in the deep ocean. And so because there's all this pressure coming on the U.S. federal government from fish farmers, they're talking about doing an end run around the state government of Alaska and establishing these, which is clearly a recipe for just a major disaster.
And don't forget, Oregon and California also have this moratorium. So he's defying all three states. And this is coming straight from the White House, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. And then we got a dispute. The DFO still won't believe that fry are being killed off by lice. So they're studying this according to what's her name? Echo Bay resident Alexandra Morton. That she says the juveniles are being killed, and the government is just studying it to death, but is not coming to any conclusion. That's because they've got a double mandate to protect, to promote the fisheries, and to promote fish farming. So between those two, DFO is stuck in a position of non-liability, and it can't act. It just seems to be completely lame.
Terrible, yeah. Yeah, it's industry-dominating government, I guess.
And speaking of California, in September, California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger vetoed Bill AB 1147, which is the California Industrial Farming, Hemp Farming Act. And this bill would have established guidelines for farming industrial hemp in California. Activists say he caved into anti-drug lobbies convinced that industrial hemp is really marijuana. So demand for hemp products has been growing steadily in recent years, with the U.S. hemp product market now exceeding an estimated $270 million in annual retail sales. This new law would have given farmers the ability to supply numerous California manufacturers that currently import hemp seed and oil, hemp seed oil and fiber. Bad news for California, but possibly good news for Canadian hemp growers wishing to export. And illegal GE rice was found in food from China. Greenpeace recently verified that illegal GE rice from China has contaminated food products in France, Germany, and the United Kingdom. Greenpeace officers and Friends of the Earth in the UK tested samples of rice products such as vermicelli, rice sticks, and other processed foods. Five positive samples were found containing an illegal GE organism not approved anywhere in the world. So that's a heads up for anything coming out of China. It seems we've had a lot of problems in the last while. Well, let's talk about the millions of birds which are vanishing in plain sight. And this is taken from the New York Times opinion page and from the 19th of June. And it's by Verlin Klinkenborg. Last week, I guess that would be sometime in June, before the 19th, and the Audubon Society released a new report describing the sharp and startling population decline of some of the most familiar and common birds in America. Several kinds of sparrows, the northern bobwhite, the eastern meadowlark, the common grackle, and the common tern. The average decline of the 20 species in the Audubon Society's report is 68%. 40 years ago, there were an estimated 31 million bobwhites. There are now 5.5 million. Compared to the 100-some condors presently in the wild, 5.5 million bobwhites sounds like a lot of birds. But what matters is the 25.5 million missing and the troubles that have brought them down. excuse me, and are all too likely to bring down the rest of them too. So this is not extinction, but it is how things look before extinction happens. The word extinct somehow brings to mind the birds that seem like special cases to us, the dodo or the great auk or the passenger pigeon. Most people would never have had a chance to see dodos and great auks on the remote islands before they were decimated in the 17th and 19th century. What is hard to remember about passenger pigeons isn't merely their enormous... What is hard to remember about passenger pigeons isn't merely their once enormous numbers. It's the enormous numbers of humans to whom their comings and goings were a common sight and who supposed, erroneously, that such unending clouds of birds were indestructible. We recognize the extraordinary distinctness of the passenger pigeon now because we know its fate, killed off largely by humans. But we have moralized it thoroughly without ever taking it to heart. So the question is whether we see the distinctness of the field sparrow, its numbers down from 18 million 40 years ago to 5.8 million, only when the last pair is being kept alive in a zoo somewhere. We love to finally care when the death watch is on. It makes us feel so very human. Like you, I've been reading dire reports of declining species for many years now. They have the value of causing us to pay attention to species in trouble, and the sad fact is that the only species likely to endure are the ones we humans manage to pay attention to. There was a time when it was better, if you were a non-human species, to be ignored by humans because we trapped, shot, or otherwise exploited all the ones that got our attention. But in the past 40 years, we have killed all those millions of birds, or let us say unintentionally caused a dramatic population loss, simply by going about business as usual.
Yes, that's dreadful, isn't it? Time we woke up.
Yeah. The Audubon Society, A Portrait of Common Bird Species in Decline, is really a report on who human beings are. Let me offer a proposition about Homo sapiens. We are the only species on Earth capable of an ethical awareness of other species, and thus the only species capable of happily ignoring that awareness. So far, our economic interests have proved to be completely incompatible with all but a very few forms of life. It's not that we believe that other species don't matter. It's that, historically speaking, it hasn't been worth believing one way or another. I don't suppose that most Americans would actively kill a whippoorwill if they had the chance. Yet in the past 40 years, its number has dropped by 1.5 million. In our everyday economic behavior, we seem determined to discover whether we can live alone on Earth. E.O. Wilson has argued eloquently and persuasively that we cannot. That who we are depends as much on the richness and diversity of the biological life around us as it does on any inherent quality in our genes. Environmentalists of every stripe argue that we must somehow begin to correlate our economic behavior, by which I mean every aspect of it, production, consumption, habitation, with the welfare of other species. This is the premise of sustainability, I know. But the very foundation of our economic interest is self-interest, and in the survival of other species, we see too little self to care. The trouble with humans is that even the smallest changes in our behavior require an epiphany. And yet, compared to the fixity of other species, the narrowness of their habitats, the strictness of their diets, the precision of the niches they occupy, we are flexibility itself. We look around us, expecting the rest of the world's occupants to adapt to the changes that we have caused, when in fact we have the right to expect adaptation only from ourselves. And that was written by Robert S. Rodvik, author, media analyst. And he says, everything faded into mist. The past was erased. The erasure was forgotten. The lie became the truth. George Orwell, 1984.
Okay, thank you very much for that, John. Now we have Dr. Rob Bennett on the phone. I would like to introduce him before speaking to him in an interview. Now, Rob Bennett has a PhD in entomology, and he's employed by the BC Ministry of Forests and Range. In his day job, he's focused on cone and seed insects, and the purpose of his work is to reduce forest losses. But today he'll be telling us about a class of non-insects called arthropods, more particularly spiders. Hi, Rob. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Good. Thank you for being on the line. We were having a bit of trouble there getting through.
Entirely my fault.
Oh, is it? Thank you for that.
I'm a government worker, so you can blame everything on me.
Oh, you're used to it, huh? Tell us now, what is the difference between a spider and an insect? Because many of us think of them in terms of being insects.
Well, spiders and insects are both belonging to the class of arthropods, which are basically, you can think of them as anything that when you step on them, they crunch. That's because they have an external skeleton, which is hard, and they have jointed legs so that they can move their inside that skeleton. But the arthropods include everything from crabs and lobsters and barnacles down through insects and spiders and daddy long legs and centipedes. The main difference between spiders and insects are that spiders generally have two main body parts and four pairs of legs attached to the first body part, and insects have three body parts with wings and three pairs of legs attached to the middle body part. So if you can keep that straight, you can usually tell the difference between an insect and a spider.
I see. Now, give us an idea of what the spider population is, will you?
Well, in terms of numbers of species worldwide, we estimate there are about 250,000 species of spiders. Only about 40 or 45,000 of those have been given Latin names, like Tegenaria duellica, which is the big funnel web spider, or some people call it a wolf spider. That's common in this neck of the woods. And in Canada, because we live in the north, and we've in the past, of course, before you or I were born, suffered all sorts of ice ages, which pushed most of our soil, flora, and fauna down south of the border, we don't have a lot of species here in Canada because of that, but we do have about 2,500 known species of spiders in Canada, and about half of those occur in British Columbia, which is which illustrates the fact that we have a hugely diverse province with all sorts of different types of habitats for different sorts of organisms, including spiders, in which to live. In terms of actual population sizes, some of your listeners might remember the McBride spider field from 2000 and a couple of years ago, 2002 or three, around about Halloween, when we estimated 60 million. Spiders, all of one species, Halorhodes cassinius, exited a farmer's clover field in the McBride area. The clover field was about 25 hectares in size, and 60 million spiders were living in there quite comfortably up until the time they decided that they needed to bail.
Why would they all go up at one time?
That's a very good question. There's a group of scientists in Britain, actually, that study exactly this sort of event, which we call mass dispersal or mass ballooning, where all the spiders in a particular area try and leave all at once, and the most visible result of that is you get huge sheets of silk left behind by the spiders as they try and leave. And it's one of the ways that spiders disperse themselves across wide areas. It's one of the reasons why, if you have say a huge forest fire or some other sort of devastating event destroying a bunch of habitat, some of the first things that recolonize an area like that are spiders. And in terms of agriculture, this is very interesting, because a farmer might plow a field or spray a bunch of pesticides on it, kill everything that's in it, or otherwise radically disturb the habitat. But very, very quickly, spiders will recolonize that habitat, a cornfield, a hayfield, a soybean field, whatever, and be in there killing and eating insects and other things that are also living in that habitat. So these mass dispersal events are basically ways that spiders disperse themselves around the world into all the various habitats.
Are they less vulnerable to insecticides and whatever pollutants man puts on the fields?
No. They're very, very vulnerable, susceptible to pesticides, and in fact, often more so than the target organisms for which which pesticides are placed on a particular crop or a forest cover, for that matter. And that's one of the reasons why generally we try and avoid pesticides as much as possible to avoid destroying beneficial organisms like spiders and certain types of insects, predatory insects, parasitic insects. that also work more or less on our behalf. Well, they're actually working on their own behalf, but we look at them as beneficial because they may be attacking insects or other organisms that we are in direct competition with, either for a corn crop or for wheat or for, like in the work that I do, for the cones and seeds that grow on conifer trees.
Oh, yes. Do you ever import spiders to control insects?
No, I never have. It's an interesting idea. One of the problems with doing something like that in any sort of operational sense is that each and every spider on the face of the earth is a predator and have evolved, or the spiders in general have evolved, to be fairly generalist in terms of their predation, so they are willing to kill and eat just about anything, including their own kind. So it's very difficult to maintain large numbers of spiders, or at least at the levels that would make it worthwhile to move them around and import them into a particular area to control something.
I see. So,
because they end up killing and eating each other, which is not the same, that doesn't generally happen with many of the insects that are reared for biological control purposes.
Now, they have some interesting practices, and one of them is the eating. Maybe you could tell us about their eating habits.
Well, the spiders in general, all spiders except for a very small minority of them, have venom glands and fangs with which they inject venom into their prey, which serves to initially paralyze their prey, and then also the venoms are enzymes that are designed to break down proteins. So not only do they immobilize the prey, but they start dissolving the muscle and fat tissue inside the inside an insect's exoskeleton, turns it to mush, a sort of insect soup, which the spider then sucks up more or less in a straw-like fashion. They don't have biting and chewing mouth parts like you or I have, or humans in general, or dogs, cats, whatever. They have a mouth that's operated by a pump inside their body, which is basically their stomach, and we call it a sucking stomach. So they exert a vacuum pressure on liquefied insect contents from inside the insect and basically suck the insect dry. So what you end up with in the web of any particular spider, if you ever looked at them and seen insect corpses in them, the insects look relatively fine, other than they might be a little bit roughed up, but they look complete, but they're actually just hollow, mere shadows of their former selves.
Oh, yes. I see those inside my house sometimes, and they're sow bugs.
Oh, yes. Yes, sow bugs are a particularly favorite prey of a particular type of spider that is normally found indoors and associated with human habitations, and it actually looks quite a lot like a black widow spider. In fact, we call it a false black widow.
Oh, yeah, not harmful.
No, not. Well, if you're a sow bug, they're definitely harmful.
Okay, and I'm not.
Other sort of insects, and also spiders that you find running around in the on the floor of your home are special targets for this false black widow house spider.
Ah, yes. Now, do all spiders spin webs?
All spiders use silk, but they don't all spin webs. In fact, you can divide them up sort of 50-50 into web weavers and spiders that actively hunt down their prey. And most of the hunters have fairly good vision. In fact, if you can think of jumping spiders, which are familiar to most people, that are quite often highly visible spiders on walls in bright sunshine and move around quite a bit, they have incredibly good eyesight and also problem-solving skills, so they can figure out how to sneak up on an insect and pounce upon it from a distance away. So they use no silk at all in terms of prey capture. It's all sort of run them down, drag them to the ground, and bite them to death. And then contrast that with the other sort of 50% of the spiders, which are web weavers that go from the ones that build the very familiar to most people, sort of bicycle wheel-shaped webs that if you're walking down a path in the late summer, you often end up with a face full of them. But a two-dimensional web that looks like a bicycle wheel with radial sticky silk lines attached to it. And they use that more or less as a fishing net to sieve out flying insects from the air. And then there are a whole pile of other different types of spiders, including the ones I mentioned earlier, the McBride spider field spiders, that build little tangly webs to take up spaces, often very close to the ground or on shrubs and grass and those sort of webs.
And some of them recycle their webs, I understand.
Certainly the garden spiders, the ones that make the radially symmetrical bicycle wheel webs, generally speaking, they recycle their webs on a 24-hour basis. Depending on the species, they'll either do that first thing in the morning or last thing in sort of the late early evening, late afternoon. They'll take down the entire web and consume the silk, and then they recycle those the proteins that the silk is made out of, and also any other sort of stuff that's attached to the web they'll ingest at that point, too, and then spin an entirely new web. And so the, those webs only last for 24 hours. The sort of cobweb-weaving spiders or funnel web spiders and those sort of spiders that build sort of space webs, mm-hmm. those webs are permanent, at least as long as the spider is around. They just keep adding to them and and do not usually take any of them, any part of them down or rebuild them.
Seems like a lot of work to recycle every 24 hours, doesn't it?
Well, it's a an energy saving aspect in terms. Mm-hmm. Well, the web, if it's in a good location, ends up being pretty tattered after 24 hours anyway. You can mm-hmm. imagine, well, birds will fly through them and destroy them, or a big insect, and the spider has a big tussle with that particular insect, in which case a lot of the web gets fairly trashed. So it's actually easier for the spider. In some cases, they'll do some immediate little repairs, but generally at the end of the day or at the end of the night, they will sort of pack it in, pull down the whole web, and build a new one. It only takes them perhaps an hour, 45 minutes to do the whole process.
Oh, yeah. And one other thing I thought I'd like to have you mention is the reproduction of the spiders.
That's actually an area that attracted me to spiders in the first place. When I went to university and studied entomology, I got very interested in spiders and ended up studying them for my master's and my PhD subject. But the reproductive behavior is what really fascinated me, and partly it's because you look back again that all the spiders are predators and to kill and eat each other, so they have to have ways and means by which the males and females can get together without killing and eating each other in order to produce new generations. So there's all sorts of behavior patterns that the spiders have evolved, particularly the males, particular types of courtship behaviors that are designed to indicate to a female that he's there for courtship and mating as opposed to serving himself up as a meal. Another interesting aspect of spider reproductive behavior is that the spiders, most spiders around here generally have a one-year life cycle, and they become sexually mature, depending on the species, usually either early in the spring or late in the summer, early in the fall. So you have two general periods where spiders are becoming sexually mature. Mm-hmm. What happens at that point, which I find incredibly fascinating, is that the males of the species start, once they're sexually mature, they start roaming around, and it's looking for receptive females, and the females sort of stay put wherever they've been living. The result of that is that you get a huge bunch of newly matured males roaming around, and a lot of these end up in people's homes. And this is why typically people seem to suffer attacks by spiders very early in the spring or late in the summer. And it's usually these newly matured males roaming around. And I kind of look at it like Saturday night downtown in the big city. All week it's been peaceful and quiet, business as usual, things are going along, and then suddenly Saturday night there's all these newly matured males roaming around looking for receptive females and causing mayhem and general havoc wherever they might happen to be, which of course is the way of all life.
Oh, okay.
But the net result is they're around for a couple of weeks in people's houses, and then because it's the end of their life cycle, they've either successfully mated or been eaten by the cat or whatever. The males all tend to disappear, and the population levels seem to disappear in homes at that time.
Yeah, I'm really sorry, Rob, but because of our difficulty in getting on the phone, we are going to have to cut this interview a little short.
All right.
But thank you so much for being on, and will you come back on another day?
I'm more than happy to. Just give me a call, and we'll set it up.
Thank you so much.
You're
Bye-bye.
Welcome. Bye.
You have been listening to an interview with Rob Bennett, who is an entomologist with the BC Ministry of Forests and Range. Now, we have our next guest on the line, and Carl, will you take over?
Yes, yes, and you're listening to Animal Voices coming to you on CFRO Radio 102.7 FM, your community-based and community-sponsored radio station. Well, Mona Benj is concerned about the recently proposed amendments to the BC Wildlife Act. And welcome to Animal Voices, Mona Benj.
Oh, thank you, Carl. It's so kind of you to have me on.
That's great. And what are your main concerns with this proposed amendment?
Well, I was actually, to begin with, I was quite happy because this is the first change that they have ever thought of doing. I think I like a big change to the Wildlife Act, and I had expected it would better reflect the changing attitudes within our society. And it seems that what they've done is really taken a big step forward into the past. I think it's more reflective of a 1950s kind of mindset with respect to wilderness and wildlife.
So maybe you can elaborate on that, because the mindset of the 50s is...
Which is not a bad thing when you come to music. But it just... I'm sorry, I interrupted you.
That's fine. I love music too. And so the 1950s, we were not all that concerned about the environment. Is that correct?
That's what I'm meaning. This is more reflective of that, and therefore I think actually more reflective of, they seem to, maybe I should go back. It starts with a hunter recruitment and retention report. And it seemed to me, after reading the proposed changes to the BC Wildlife Act, that they took a lot of them from the report. And the report is one that is the most important thing, I think, that people have to see out of this report, is that the ministry is going to recruit, as they call it, recruit 20,000 new hunters into BC over the next few years. And that appears to me to be in direct conflict with not only the changing in social norms that we see now with respect to wilderness and wildlife, but also to the way that the province is being promoted to the world. You know, I mean, tourism and 2010, they both are green-themed. They're inviting people to come here, see our wonderful wilderness that we're so fortunate to still have, and the wildlife within it. And yet at the same time, the Ministry of Environment is going to proceed to make it easier for people to hunt. They're going to lower the cost of licenses. They are going to directly market to young hunters and female hunters. And they want to, according to the report, and this is not reflected in the changes that they list, they want to make it more cool to hunt. And I think they're missing the boat, frankly.
Now, ecotourism has, of course, taken on people view without their guns. And, of course, what is the balance here between the financial benefit to the provincial government from having ecotourists and having hunters?
Well, that was interesting. You probably saw the Sun article in which they said there that the tourism stats show that for 48 million contributed by hunting, which also includes anglers, so it's probably substantially less, that there's 900 million generated by wildlife viewing, commercial rafting, heli-skiing, and that's according to the BC Wilderness Tourism Association. And so, you know, and then another person I spoke to says that studies have shown that for every dollar that comes in from a hunter, $4 comes in from a tourist that wants to take a camera into the wilderness and get pictures. So it seems that they're just going in the wrong direction with this.
Now, do we know exactly, like we're talking about many of the different species, I'm thinking of grizzlies and bears, do we actually have an accurate idea of how many of these species there are in the woods?
Well, you know, honestly, Carl, I don't know. And I think that you bring up a very good point. I mean, I'm not a biologist. So that's not my expertise. I'm a citizen that is of BC, and I'm very concerned, and I'm glad you've had me on, because I think that every citizen of BC should be concerned about the direction that they're taking and make their opinions known. And they can do that by going to the Ministry of Environment website, and they're taking public comment, which is a very positive thing. Now, you're asking me about the species. I mean, it seems to me that all the species are under under attack, but they are in a problem, which is growing larger because there's urban encroachment, there's tourist encroachment, there's resource encroachment upon their habitats. And so our Ministry of Environment that talks about conservation should actually be establishing what you suggest. They should be establishing what those numbers are before they do any of this, don't you think?
Absolutely. And I was also, it was mentioned that the government was actually in the documents that they put out, that they were recruiting non-European Asians. What's the implication of that as far as hunting bears in particular is concerned?
Well, I think that, there's certainly been enough in the news about a concern that bear gallbladders and paws, for example, are being poached. And, again, I would really suggest that you have somebody on that knows a lot more about that than I do. And I'm not trying to suggest that all Asian people would only be going out to do that. But I wonder why. I mean, the question needs to be asked, why would they be doing that? The ministry, I mean.
Now, a BC citizen to be able to hunt a bear, I mean, I couldn't believe the figures there. It's very inexpensive. Is that correct?
So I understand. I believe you have the figures, don't you?
Like if I want to go and shoot a bear, it's $7?
It's unbelievable, isn't it?
It is. And, I don't even need a license if I want to hunt ducks.
Yeah.
So, one of the aspects that came into my mind, which is somewhat off the Wildlife Act, which I think needs revision, and many of these organizations are masquerading as environmental, but in fact they are hunting groups, and I feel that the time has come where people need to stand up and say, well, let's have the honest truth here. Your figures are dramatically down for good reasons. People are not going out there hunting because they prefer to see the animals. And, of course, there's the aspect of letting nature take its course to find the balance without the ever presence of humans interfering with nature. But there's also the aspect of the farmers. Involved with this legislation to that hunters would go to the areas where there is problem to protect farmers. And the government has always sided with these farmers, as we know from earlier. John was talking about the factory farming of salmon, and it seems to be that we're always. The government seems to be lopsided here. And again, with this Wildlife Act, we're seeing that, don't you think?
I think so. And I think, again, it's so evident that what one needs is balance, and not to reflect the or to respond to a dwindling special interest group.
Right.
And if the market shows that, for example, in the report itself, it says that the sale of hunting licenses has declined by 50% since 1982. What I say is that this market shift reflects the change in public attitude. People are moving away from hunting wildlife for entertainment to a preference to view and photograph it in a protected habitat. And I think that's what the majority of citizens, if they think about it, would expect from their government, especially from a Ministry of Environment that one believes has something to do with conservation.
Right.
And I don't know how you feel, but I think there should be more conservation officers out there rather than more hunters.
That's correct. And, of course, this whole idea of trying to create 20,000 new hunters in BC,
I
mean, that's 20,000 animals and possibly bears. But is there an easy web page where people can write on this issue and get some information?
Yes. It's the... if you go to the Wildlife Act Review at government.bc.ca.
Okay.
Wildlife Act Review at government.gov.bc.ca.
Yes, thank you, Mona Binge, for being on Animal Voices and for raising this very important issue of conservation of wildlife in British Columbia.
Oh, thank you, Carl. And may I, do I have 1 second to say one more thing?
Go ahead.
Anybody that writes in or if they phone their MLA, could they ask them to stop the black bear spring bear hunt? In Ontario, that was stopped on humane reasons in 1998. And yet it is in this act they are proposing to extend the spring bear hunt. And because people cannot tell the difference between a male and a female, that will mean that hundreds of little orphan bear cubs that cannot fend for themselves will be left to starve in the forest because so many females are shot with cubs.
Thank you, Mona Binge.
Okay. Thank you so much, Carl.
Bye for now.
Yes, thank you, Carl and Mona. That was very interesting. And now we're going to hear from All Art, who is going to be finishing a discussion she started last week. Go ahead.
Yes, last week we were talking about chimeras. That's spelled C-H-I-M-E-R-A. And it's pronounced chimera or chimera. And what it is it's stem cell research with regards to mixing human and animal cells together. And recently in the news, just a quick recap from last week, it's been in the news lately in Britain, where it's a highly permissive environment for doing this kind of experimentation, that there's a big controversy has been breaking out, and the government is getting involved because the scientists are doing a variety of these experiments where they're mixing up these cells with animals and humans. And the government has gotten into the picture and said, you know, we want to regulate this. And so we want you to, if you're going to do this, you have to kill these things, these products, in about 10 days or 14 days. Now, the bishops and the Catholic Church has gotten involved because they say, well, anything that's brought to life should not be killed. And so they're saying, first of all, we don't think that anything, that you should bring these things into life in the first place, because it is a blasphemy. It takes the image of God, man being the image of God, mixing it up with animal cells somehow is a defilement of that image of God. So it shouldn't happen in the first place. But then they say, if it's going to happen, then we don't think that life should be killed once it has come to life. And so they're suggesting that if it's mostly human, like 99% human and 1% animal, that then it might be okay to transplant that into the womb of a woman, which is, I find, kind of repulsive, and allow it to go into fruition. That any, you know, but then you say, well, is 2% animal still okay? 5%? 10%? What line do you say it's okay, not okay to put it into the womb of a woman? So to me, I think that the bishops should have held their ground on the sanctity of life and left it at that. The minute they started saying it's okay to transplant these things into the womb of women, you know, they lost me on that. However, I digress. Let me go on. I wanted to tell you last week about the kinds of experiments that have been done. And so there's a lot of these experiments that have been published in the last few years, and some of them consist of growing human cells in immature animals, creating chimeric organisms. Chimeric, again, meaning the mixture of these two organisms. It's an organism that comes out of this mixture. So one group is reported in a number of studies, injected human stem cells from adult bone marrow, that's human adult bone marrow, into fetal sheep. And they found that the cells were distributed throughout the sheep's body and differentiated into human blood, liver, skin, and heart cells. And I have another article with regards to that kind of experiment that says that the sheep have 15% human cells and 85% animal cells. And their evolution brings the prospect of animal organs being transplanted into humans one step closer. I'm getting repulsed again. Anybody else? Professor Ismail Zanjani of the University of Nevada has spent 7 years and £5 million perfecting the technique, which involves injecting adult human cells into a sheep's fetus. He's already created a sheep liver, which has a large proportion of human cells, and eventually hopes to precisely match a sheep to a transplant patient using that patient's own stem cells to create their own flock of sheep. So the process would involve extracting stem cells from the donor's bone marrow, injecting them into the peritoneum of a sheep's fetus, and when the lamb is born, 2 months later, it would have the liver, heart, lungs, and brain that are partially human and available for transplant. Now, this, of course, revives criticisms about scientists playing God, and there's also thoughts of, well, what about the possibility of silent viruses that are being created by this process? And maybe viruses that are harmful in animals, but being introduced into the human race, because mutant animal viruses are a real threat, as we've seen with HIV. Now, some other experiments that happened was another group injected human stem cells from adult bone marrow into fetal pigs and found human cells throughout the pig's blood. Fused pig-human cell hybrids were also found in the epithelium. Another team discovered that human blood cells from umbilical cords injected into the livers of immunodeficient newborn mice led to the development of human immunological cells and lymph nodes in the mice. And none of these studies mentioned whether human cells differentiated into brain cells or human gametes, meaning the reproductive organs in the animals, either of which could be ethically problematic. I mean, can you imagine if it developed into the reproductive organs and then these animals reproduced? I mean, where the lines get blurred into, well, then how much is the animal, how much of it is human? The offspring, how much of it is human, how much of it is not? But, you know, scientists like to play. So some experiments had the specific purpose of transplanting human stem cells from the brains of other animals. Now, this significantly affects the identity of the animal. And so they took stem cells from human cord blood into adult rat brains, and the human stem cells were found to differentiate into neuron-like cells inside the rat brain and had disseminated widely throughout the brain. The human cells could be detected in the rat brains up to 3 months post-transplantation.
What is the purpose? I have to ask that question. Why? Why are they doing this?
Well, the scientists, of course, say that this enables them, like as I mentioned with the sheep experiment, is they're saying, well, if they can make the sheep have partly human organs, liver, skin, you know, hearts, then they can perhaps prepare them in the future for transplants, or they can experiment then on these animals' organs that are now partly human in the hopes that they can better understand how to cure certain diseases like Parkinson's disease and a variety of other diseases. That's their justification. I mean, there's always a justification, right?
Yeah. Not a very good one, though,
no,
is it?
No, it's not. I mean,
part animal, part human, or both aren't animals, of course, but part of two species isn't the same as part of one species.
No.
Surely.
No, it isn't.
No.
And speaking of, you know, when I mentioned about the reproductive organs, it says if the gametes of the humans and those of a species with a different number of chromosomes were mixed in vitro, well, it's highly unlikely that fertilization would occur or that embryo would develop to the fetal stage. I mean, however, the combination of gametes from humans and non-human primates to make a hybrid would be of greater concern because the chromosome number is close between non-human primates and humans. Mm-hmm. So there could be theoretically fewer problems with chromosome allocation during mitosis. Humans have 46 chromosomes, while chimpanzees and gorillas have 48. So the creation of a human animal, especially primate chimera, at the embryonic or fetal stage would be ethically problematic, especially if the chimera involved transplantation of brain or gonadal cells. Now, there's one thing that I find really interesting. God, there's so much to say, and I'm running out of time again. We may have to do more. And that is with regards to what we've all been told, a lot of us have heard, that we are so closely related to chimpanzees and apes and gorillas that we're 98%, 99% the DNA is a match. Now, that's highly misleading, and I have some information with regards to that I'd like to read you. It says, there are nonetheless significant differences between non-human primates and humans. Although it's been estimated that the genomes of humans and chimpanzees are approximately 98% to 99% genetically similar, This claim is misleading for several reasons. When DNA or protein sequences are compared, percentages are commonly used to denote the differences. Scientists find percentages useful because they are a precise numerical way of denoting the difference. However, their use does not necessarily always denote accuracy or reflect reality fully. A percentage is a scalar one-dimensional measure. A body part produced by genes is a three-dimensional entity. So a quantitative percentage in difference between interspecies stretches of DNA or protein does not reveal the qualitative differences in physiology, behavior, and intelligence, which are produced by the DNA, all of which are significantly different between man and chimp. So I think it's important to know that, because I always thought when I heard 98-90% similar, I thought there's something wrong with that statement. Mm-hmm. So now we know why it's misleading. Mm-hmm. Anyways, I have to wrap it up. There's so much more I wanted to say. There's so many ethical problems with this, and perhaps we can go into them more on another date. So thank you for listening.
This is science gone mad, believe me.
Oh, yeah, it's bestiality in a petri dish.
Yeah, disgusting stupidity.
Yeah. Thank you for that, Art. And we're going to have a bit of music now from Alan.
I held on for so long, dusty quaint old song. Things attached with glue, live and die and gone. June flowers are so bold on the devil's paintbrush road. The devil paints a double life and there I dare not go. Live and die and gone, live and die and gone. The devil paints a double life, live and die and gone.
That was just a little bit of the Devil's Paintbrush Road with the Waylon Jennings. You can hear the rest of that song and a lot more at next week's Folk Festival, where Waylon Jennings are one of the feature artists. And at the end of today's show, we've got a pair of tickets to give away to Saturday's Folk Festival for somebody who wants to become a member. We'll tell you about that then, but back to the show.
Okay, we've got Allard again. Fortunately, we found a couple of extra minutes for her, and we'd like to have her back. Thanks.
Okay, so let me continue on. I have so much more to say. All right. So now, when we're talking about the primate-human combination, too, or any of these combinations, of course, one of the ethical questions is, well, you know, if you've got part human cells in this animal and it is being allowed to grow, I mean, at what point do you allow it the same kind of human dignity? I mean, we have the 13th Amendment in the U.S., and we have the Charter of Rights and Bill of Rights in Canada, which basically acknowledges intrinsic rights that human beings have, you know, the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and to not be molested in their pursuit of these things. However, we don't seem to, in our superiority, think anything of molesting and torturing and killing and experimenting on these animals. But if we even want to just, for a moment, think in terms of our superior human rights, well, at what point do we say, okay, well, if there's 15% human cells in this human sheep creature, at what point do we accord it some sort of human rights? You know, at what percentage do we accord it human rights? I mean, we don't think of giving it any rights when it's an animal, but as soon as it starts becoming human, we say, well, at what percentage? Mm-hmm. So, you know, I mean, of course I'm saying it's animals have a right to be not messed around with at all, but, you know, scientists and even the church don't seem to have arrived at that one yet, so.
Well, the church, you said, didn't believe in killing something that has life. Well, are they all vegan? Vegetarian?
No, I don't think so. But
I think it's just humans that they don't believe in.
Well, and they don't seem to think much of women's bodies either, by the fact that they would be willing to put this embryo that's part animal now into a mother's womb, a human mother's womb, to allow it to fruition.
Right.
Because they're saying there's no way you can put that in an animal because it's just, you can't, because it's partly human now. Or it's mostly human, so it couldn't possibly be allowed to be put in an animal. I'm wondering about the likelihood of these things growing to fruition anyways. But let me carry on here. There's a Dr. Leon Kass, he's a former chairman of the President's Council of Bioethics, has written of the wisdom of repugnance. He says, in analyzing this sort of thing, revulsion is not an argument. He says, in crucial cases, however, repugnance is the emotional expression of deep wisdom beyond reason's power to fully articulate it. Shallow are the souls that have forgotten how to shudder. So he's basically saying that if you hear all this stuff and you feel this repugnance, this revulsion inside you, as I think is natural, then that perhaps is a sign of your wisdom. And whether it be God in the Christian sense or God or the Creator in whatever religion you're in, whatever Creator, if they did not design, that Creator did not design humans and any animal to mate or procreate out in the physical level, then I can't imagine that God or Creator says, but it's okay to do it in a petri dish, or it's okay to do these experiments. And you know, so there's something wrong with this. So,
and human, we know that when we mess with things, we make it worse, don't we? We've proven that over and over again in this world.
Well, we have, but sandwiched in the midst of that are some successes, which of course then causes them to justify. They hold up the successes, they ignore the failures, mm-hmm. but they hold up the successes as justification for continuing.
I think it's dubious whether there ever has been successes. I think if you look into the so-called successes, I mean, John has talked a lot about this when we're talking about anti-vivisection. And very often, if you're looking at those successes, they're not really successes.
No.
Yeah, they're just promises and hope. Yeah. That's all they're selling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the fact that that human embryonic stem cells introduced into non-human hosts might be able to generate gametes, I mean, reproductive organs, mm-hmm. well, and these then should not be allowed to mate, because the line becomes blurry as to
absolutely
as to how much human is in that offspring now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, I guess we're going to have to call.
At any rate, okay, well, I guess we're wrapping it up here. Again, there's always so much more to say. So as I have more information for you, I'll bring it to you. Thanks,
well,
Susan.
Well, thank you so much for that. Sorry for the unfortunate interruptions, All Art.
But can't hear.
Alan, we're not getting through, maybe?
Got time for a minute of a comment by Dr. Witthoff from his book, People and Animals. Half a minute?
Well, a half a minute. We don't... half a minute. Half a minute.
Here we go. If there had been no animal experimentation or vivisection, reliance had been placed on clinical research and observation for finding out about the human body, and if there had been a real study of the human being as a person rather than as a machine, we would doubtless not now be threatened by science with such monstrous scientific goals as head transplants, deep freezing of human beings, an indefinite prolongation of life, radical alteration of the human mind by drugs and other means, remote control of humans by means of electrodes implanted in the brain, the creation of man-animal chimeras. The world would not be saddened and threatened by an increasing number of scientists and technologists who are being conditioned by their laboratory employment to callous disregard of animal suffering, leading inevitably to callous disregard of human suffering. There would not now be a growing number of people greatly distressed by the appalling cruelties which they know go on in laboratories. There would not now be a worldwide epidemic of torture where techniques are used similar to those that have been used on animals for many years. There would not now be a predominantly experimental medicine in the Western world instead of a clinical medicine. There would be less disease and greater happiness, and perhaps this planet would not now be in greater danger of destruction due to cruel and greedy exploitation of its treasures by its human inhabitants than at any time since the world began.
Lots of food for thought in these presentations. I believe we really are out of time now, so thanks for listening to Animal Voices. We'll be back next Friday.